Jesus, Teaching in Genesareth and Banks of the Jordan, Part 18. Jesus in Abila and Gadara. Jesus with the disciples and accompanied by the Levites went 3 hours to the northwest toward a deep dale through which the brook Cherith flowed to the Haramax. In this dale lay the beautiful city of Abila, built around the source of the brook Cherith. The Levites accompanied him to a mountain that stood halfway on the road, and then went back to Betharam. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon when the Levites of Abila, among whom were several Rechabites, received Jesus outside the city. 3 of the disciples from Galilee were with the Levites awaiting his arrival. They conducted him at once into the city and to a very lovely fountain, the source of the brook Cherith. The beautiful little edifice, supported by columns that it had built over the source, formed the central point, to which ran colonnades connecting it with the synagogue and other public buildings. The city was built on both sides of the gently rising height. The streets ran from these central buildings in the form of a star, so that from every one of them the fountain could be seen. It was at this fountain that the Levites washed the feet of Jesus and the disciples, and offered them the customary refreshments. In the neighboring gardens and on the buildings around were men and maidens busily preparing for the Feast of Tabernacles. From here, Jesus accompanied the Levites northward, about half an hour outside the city, into the valley to where a broad stone bridge was built over the stream. On it, in memory of Elias, was a low pedestal or column, surmounted by a cupola resting on 8 pillars. The pedestal supported a pulpit, to which the teacher mounted by steps. Both banks of the narrow stream were cut in tiers to afford seats for the audience, and both were now crowded with people. In addressing them, Jesus turned from side to side that all might hear. Today was a feast in the city commemorative of Elias, of something that had happened to him here by the stream. The instruction was followed by a banquet at the baths and pleasure garden outside the city. The festival ended with the Sabbath, because on the following day, a fast was kept in remembrance of the murder of Gedalias. 25:22-25. The sound of trumpets was still heard during the day. On the declivity of the mountain west of the city of Abila, I saw a very beautiful sepulchre, in front of which was a little garden. In the latter were assembled the women belonging to 3 families of Abila. They were celebrating a solemnity in honor of the dead. They sat on the ground closely veiled, wept, uttered lamentations, and frequently prostrated with the face to the earth. They killed several birds of very beautiful plumage, plucked them, and burned the lovely shining feathers on the tomb. The flesh was afterward given to the poor. The tomb was that of an Egyptian woman from whom the mourners had descended. Before the departure of the children of Israel, there lived in Egypt an illegitimate relative of the Pharaoh, then reigning. She was very favorably disposed toward Moses and rendered great services to the Israelites. She was a prophetess, and she it was that had discovered Joseph's mummy to Moses on the last night of his stay in Egypt. Her name was Segula, and she was the mother of Aaron's wife, from whom, however, he separated and married Elizabeth, the daughter of Amminadab of the tribe of Judah. The repudiated wife also was connected in some way with Amminadab, but how I do not now know. She had by her mother Segula, as well as by Aaron himself, been richly dowered. Taking with her large treasure, she accompanied the Israelites on their departure and married a second time during their stay in the desert. She afterward attached herself to the Midianites, especially to the family of Jethro. Her descendants settled near Abila, where they dwelt under tents, and it was here that she was buried. After the time of the prophet Elias, Abila was built, and it was then that those descendants settled here. I did not see the city in Elias's time. It may have been destroyed before him. There were still 3 families of those descendants in Abila, and they were celebrating today the anniversary of the death of their ancestress, Segula's daughter, whose mummy had been transported hither from the desert and entombed. The woman made an offering of the earrings and other trinkets to the Levites in memory of their deceased relative. Jesus praised her from the pulpit of Elias and spoke of the goodness of Segula, her mother. The women listened attentively from where they stood behind the men. There were numbers of poor at the banquet in the bathing garden, and every guest was obliged before partaking of the viands to give something from his own plate to his poor neighbor. I saw the Levites conducting Jesus next day into a great court, all around which were cells. Here were found about 20 patients, some of them deaf and dumb, others blind and from their birth, who were cared for by attendants and two physicians. It was a kind of hospital. The deaf and dumb were exactly like children. Each had a little garden in which he amused himself and raised flowers. Soon all gathered around Jesus, laughing and pointing with their finger to their mouth. Jesus stooped and wrote all kinds of signs in the sand with his finger. They watched him attentively and, at every mark he made, pointed around them to this or that object. It was in this way that he made them understand something about God. I know not whether he formed letters or figures, or whether the mutes had ever before been instructed in that way. After that, Jesus put his finger into their ears and touched them under the tongue with his thumb and forefinger. They shuddered as if a shock thrilled through their whole being. They gazed around, they heard, they wept, they stammered, they talked. They cast themselves down at Jesus' feet and broke forth into a most touching, monotonous chant of a few words. It sounded almost like that sweet singing I heard in the caravan of the Holy Three Kings. Then Jesus turned to the blind men who were standing still in a row. He prayed and laid his two thumbs on their eyes. They opened their eyes, fixed them upon their Savior and Redeemer, and mingled their songs of praise with those of the once deaf and dumb, but who could now extol his goodness and listen to his words. Oh, what a charming, what a joyous scene! No words can describe it. The whole city crowded in joy and jubilation to hail Jesus as he came forth from the court surrounded by the miraculously cured whom he had ordered to bathe. After that, Jesus, with the disciples and Levites, traversed the city to the pulpit of Elias. The excitement throughout the city was great. At the news of the miracles just wrought, several possessed had been set at large. On a corner of one of the streets, some women, poor simpletons, ran after Jesus, chattering and repeating the words, "Jesus of Nazareth, prophet, thou art a prophet. Thou art Jesus. Thou art the Christ, the prophet." They were harmless fools. Jesus commanded them to be silent, and they became quiet. He laid his hand on their heads, and they fell on their knees in tears. Silent and confused, they allowed themselves to be quietly led away by their friends. Then several possessed pressed raging through the crowd as if to tear Jesus to pieces. He cast upon them a single glance, and they fell like whining dogs at his feet. With a word of command, he drove the devil forth. They sank down unconscious. A dark vapor escaped from them, and then they arose weeping and thanking, and were led to their homes by their friends. Jesus generally ordered such persons to perform certain purifications. He again taught from the pulpit on the brook, alluding in the course of his instruction to Elias, to Moses, and to the departure of the Israelites from Egypt. He spoke of the cures that had just been effected in their midst, and of the prophecies which declared that in the Messiah's time the dumb would speak and the blind see. He also made allusion to those that saw these signs and yet would not acknowledge them. I saw on that occasion many things connected with Elias. He was a tall, spare man, with hollow reddish cheeks, a bright, piercing glance, a long, thin beard, and a bald head with only a circle of hair around the back. On the top of his head were three large protuberances, almost of the form of bulbs, one in the middle, two somewhat toward the forehead. He wore a garment made of two skins fastened together, on the shoulder open at the sides, and bound around the waist with a cord. Over his shoulders and around his knees hung the hair of the beast's skin. He carried a staff in his hand. His shins were far darker than his face. He was 9 months in Abla, and 2 years and 3 months in Sarepta with the widow. While at Abla, he dwelt in a cave on the eastern slope of the valley not far from the brook. I saw how the bird brought him food. At first there arose a little dark figure, like a shadow out of the earth, holding in its hand a thin cake. It was neither man nor beast. It was the evil one, come to tempt the prophet. Elias would not touch the bread, but bade the tempter be gone. Then I saw a bird coming to the vicinity of his cave with bread and other food, which it hid under the leaves as if for itself. It must have been a waterfowl, for it was web-footed. Its head was somewhat broad, and by the side of the beak hung bags something like pockets, and under the beak hung a craw. It made a cracking noise with its bill like a stork. I saw that this bird was quite at home with Elias, so much so that on a sign from the prophet it came and went. I saw him pointing to it right and left. I have often seen the same kind of bird with the hermits, also with Zazimuth and Mary of Egypt. The Hebrew word, which is translated as raven, chorus 17, signifies, according to the interpreters of Holy Scripture, various kinds of birds, among them with colored feathers and a long beak. See Calmet SSV. When Elias was with the widow of Sarepta, besides the oil and meal that never decreased, other food was sometimes brought him by ravens. Jesus went with the Levites to the cave of Elias. On the eastern declivity of the valley, under a broad, overhanging cliff, was a narrow, rocky bank upon which Elias, under shelter of the upper rock, used to sleep on a couch overgrown with moss. When the Sabbath, on the fourth of the month Tisri, began, and the fast was over, there was an entertainment in the bathing gardens, at which again the poor were fed. Next morning, after Jesus had again taught and cured the sick in the synagogue, he went with the disciples, the Levites, the Rechabites, and some of the citizens to the western heights of the mountain. There, making a circuit of about an hour, he went through the vineyards giving instructions. On this mountain range, as far as Gadara, were numerous rocky projections like mounds. Some had been raised by nature, others formed by the hand of man, and around them vines were planted, the vine stalks as thick as one's arm. They were planted far apart, and threw out their branches to a great distance. The bunches of fruit were often as long as one's arm, while the single grapes were as large as plums. The leaves were larger than those of our vines, though small when compared with the fruit. The Levites put many questions to Jesus upon different portions of the Psalms that treated of the Messiah. They said, "Thou art certainly the greatest prophet after the Messiah. Thou canst explain these points to us." Among other things, there was question of the words, "And of him that with blood besprinkled garments trod the winepress alone," 63:3. Jesus explained all to them with its profound signification and applied it to himself. During this little instruction, they sat around one of the vine hills eating grapes. The Rechabites, however, would not touch the fruit, because they were forbidden to drink wine. But Jesus challenged them upon their abstinence and commanded them to eat, saying that if they sinned by so doing, he would take the guilt upon himself. When they brought forward their law as an excuse for not complying, I heard them saying that Jeremias, on the command of God, had once forbidden it, and they had obeyed. But now that Jesus ordered otherwise, they hearkened to his word. Toward evening, they returned to the city and assisted at another entertainment to which the poor were admitted. Then Jesus taught in the synagogue and afterward went to the house of the Levites, where he passed the night on the roof under a tent. Attended by the Levites, Jesus went from Abila to Gadara and reached the small Jewish quarter of the city in the evening. It was separate from the larger pagan quarter, which had as many as four idolatrous temples. I knew at once that Gadara was a heathen city from seeing the idol of Baal standing under a large tree. Jesus was well received here. There were Pharisees and Sadducees among the inhabitants, also a Sanhedrin for the country around, although the male Jews of the place numbered from 300 to 400 only. Jesus found some Galilean disciples awaiting him in Gadara. They were Nathanael, Chased, Jonathan, Peter's half-brother, and I think Philip. Jesus put up at the inn outside the Jewish quarter, where already a great number of arbors had been erected for the Feast of Tabernacles. Next morning, when Jesus went to the synagogues to preach, he was met by a great crowd of sick, who had assembled outside to wait for him, and also by several raging possessed. The Pharisees and Sadducees, though apparently well disposed, wanted to drive these people away. They should not be so importunate, they said. It was not the time for that. But Jesus very graciously interposed. "Let them remain," he said, "for it was for them that I came," and he cured many of them. The Jewish Sanhedrin of Gadara were meantime deliberating whether or not they should allow Jesus to teach, since so much was said against him. They unanimously resolved to permit him to do so, for they had heard him very well spoken of, especially after the cure of the son of the centurion of Capernaum. The disciples lately arrived spoke to Jesus of another person at Capernaum who greatly needed his assistance. In the synagogue, Jesus taught of Elias, of Ahab and Jezebel, and of the idol of Baal erected in Samaria. And speaking of Elias, Jesus said that he had not received bread from ravens because he had been disobedient. There is also some allusion made to King Balthasar of Babylon, who had desecrated the sacred vessels and had seen the writing on the wall. Jesus taught long and earnestly from Isaiah, most strikingly applying the prophet's word to himself and uttering profound thoughts upon his own approaching passion and victory. He spoke of the winepress, of the red bloody garments, of the lonely worker, of the nations trodden down in wrath. He had previously spoken of the rebuilding of Sion, of the watchmen upon the walls of the holy city, and I felt that he was alluding to the church. To me, his teaching, though so profound and earnest, was so clear, and yet the Jewish doctors, though surprised and deeply affected, failed to understand him. That night, they met together, consulted the scriptures, weighed and compared various passages. They thought that he must surely be allied to some neighboring nation, and that he would soon return with a powerful army and conquer Judea. The idol Baal, under a wide-spreading tree outside the entrance of the pagan quarter, was of metal. It had a broad head and an immense mouth. The head went up in a point like a sugar loaf, and round it was a wreath of leaves like a crown. The idol, short, broad, and chunky, looked like an ox sitting upright. In one hand it held a bunch of corn, and in the other some kind of plant, perhaps grapes, or something similar. There were seven openings in its body, and it sat in a kind of cauldron in which a fire could be lighted under it. On its feasts, the idol was clothed. Gadara was a stronghold. The pagan quarter was tolerably large and somewhat sheltered by the highest peak of the mountain, at whose northern base were warm baths and beautiful buildings. On the following morning, as Jesus was curing numbers of sick outside the city, the priests approached to salute him. "Why," said he, addressing them, "why were you so disturbed last night over my teaching of yesterday? Why should you tremble before an army, since God protects the just? Fulfill the law and the prophets. Why then should ye fear?" Jesus again taught in the synagogue as on the preceding day. Toward noon, a pagan woman timidly approached the disciples and implored them to bring Jesus to her house, that he might cure her child. Jesus went with several of his disciples into the pagan quarter. The woman's husband met him at the gate and led him into the house. The wife cast herself at Jesus' feet, saying, "Master, I have heard of thy wonders, and that thou canst perform greater prodigies than Elias. Behold, my only boy is dying, and our wise lady cannot help him. Do thou have pity on us." The boy, about 3 years old, lay in a little crib in the corner. The evening before, the father had taken the child into the vineyard and had eaten a few grapes. Soon after, the boy became sick. The father had to take him back home, whimpering loudly. The mother had held him all night in her arms, vainly trying to relieve him. He already wore the appearance of death. Indeed, he looked as if he might really be dead. At this point, the mother had hastened to the Jewish quarter to implore Jesus' aid, for the heathens had heard of the cures wrought by him on the day before. Jesus said to her, "Leave me alone with the child, and send to me two of my disciples." Then came Judas Barsabbas and Nathanael the bridegroom. Jesus took the boy from his crib into his arms, laid him on his breast to breast, pressed him to himself, bowed his face upon the face of the child, and breathed on him. The child opened his eyes and rose up, and Jesus held him out in his arms and commanded the two disciples to lay their hands upon the child's head and to bless him. They obeyed, and the child was cured. Jesus then took him to the anxiously awaiting parents, who, embracing the child, cast themselves down at Jesus' feet. The mother cried out, "Great is the God of Israel. He is far above all the gods. My husband has already told me that, and henceforth I will serve no other God." A crowd soon gathered, and several other children were brought to the Lord. He cured one little boy of a year old by the imposition of hands. Another of 7 years was a simpleton and subject to convulsions arising from possession by the evil one. The child did not endure any violent assaults, but he was often paralyzed and speechless. Jesus blessed him and ordered him a bath of 3 different waters, some from the warm spring of Amethyst, north of the base of the mountain of Gadara, some from the brook of Kereth near Abila, and lastly some from the river Jordan. The Jews of these parts kept on hand some of the water of the Jordan, taken from the point over which Elias had crossed. They preserved it in leathern bottles and used it in cases of leprosy. The pagan mothers complained of the frequent illnesses of their children and the little assistance they derived from the priestess in such trials. Jesus commanded the priestess to be summoned before him. She obeyed reluctantly, for she did not want to enter Jesus' presence. She was closely enveloped in veils. Jesus ordered her to draw near, but she would not look at him. She turned her face away and behaved exactly like the possessed. She was irresistibly forced to turn away from the glance of Jesus, though at his command she approached. Jesus, addressing the pagan men and women before him, said, "I will show you now what wisdom you reverence in this woman, and what is her skill." And he commanded the spirits to leave her. Thereupon, a black vapor issued from her, and all kinds of figures, noxious insects, snakes, toads, rats, dragons, withdrew from her like shadows. It was a horrible sight. Jesus exclaimed, "Behold what doctrine ye follow!" The woman fell upon her knees, weeping and sobbing. She was now quite changed, quite tractable, and Jesus ordered her to disclose by what means she had tried to cure the children. With many tears and half reluctantly, she obeyed. She told that she had been taught to make the children sick by charms and witchcraft, that she might afterward cure them for the honor of the gods. Jesus then commanded her to accompany him and the disciples to where the god Moloch was kept, and he directed several of the pagan priests to be called. The crowd had gathered, for the news of the child's cure was soon spread. The place to which Jesus now went was not a temple, but a hill surrounded by tombs. The god was in a subterranean vault in the midst of them. The vault was closed on top by a cover. Jesus told the pagan priests to call forth their god. When by means of machinery they had caused the idol to rise into sight, Jesus expressed to them his regret that they had a god that was unable to help himself. Then turning to the priestess, he commanded her to rehearse the praises of her god, tell how she served him, and what reward he gave her. Like Balaam and the prophet, the woman began to repeat aloud before all the people the horrors of Moloch's worship and the wonders of the God of Israel. Jesus then directed the disciples to upset the idol and to shake it violently. They did as commanded. Jesus said to the pagans, "Behold the God that ye serve. Behold the spirits that ye adore." And in the sight of all present, there appeared all kinds of diabolical figures issuing from the idol. They trembled convulsively, crept around for a while, and vanished into the earth among the tombs. The idolaters gazed at the scene in affright and confusion. Jesus said, "If we cast your God down again into his den, he will surely go to pieces." The priests implored Jesus not to destroy their idol, whereupon he allowed them to raise it as before and lower it into its place. Most of the idolaters were deeply touched and ashamed, especially the priests, although some were very indignant. The people were, however, on Jesus' side. He gave them a beautiful instruction, and many were converted. Moloch was seated like an ox on his hind legs, his forepaws stretched out like the arms of the one who is going to receive something upon them, but by means of machinery he could be made to draw them in. His gaping mouth disclosed an enormous throat, and on his forehead was one crooked horn. He was seated in a large basin. Around the body were several projections like outside pockets. On festival days, long straps were hung around his neck. In the basin under him, fire was made when sacrifices were to be offered. Around the rim of the basin, numbers of lamps were kept constantly burning before the god. Once upon a time, it was customary to sacrifice children to him, but now they dared no longer do so, and animals of all kinds were offered in their stead. They were consumed in the openings of his body or cast into his yawning jaws. The sacrifice most agreeable to him was an angora goat. There was also a machine by which the priests and others could descend to the idol in the subterranean vault among the tombs. The worship of Moloch was, however, no longer in great repute. He was invoked chiefly for purposes of sorcery, and especially by the mothers of sick children. Each pocket around his person was consecrated to special sacrifices. Children used to be laid on his arms and consumed by the fire under him and in him, for he was hollow. He drew his arms in when the victim was deposited upon them, and pressed it tightly that its screams might not be heard. There was machinery in the hind legs by which he could be made to rise. He was surrounded with rays. On it, in memory of Elias,